When you look around, does it seem to you that less and less people believe in God or in organized religion? It seems that way to me. Even those who claim to be believers are more apt to call themselves spiritual, but not religious. And they typically hold some mishmash of religious doctrines from a variety of religious traditions. According to a recent Pew study, about one-third of all U.S. adults are religiously unaffiliated, with this number sharply increasing among millennials and Gen Zers, which actually makes religiously unaffiliated the fastest growing religion, if you could call it that, since there is no real uniformity in belief among them. As far as believing in God goes, recent studies indicate that as many as 4% of U.S. adults do not believe in God, that is, are atheists, and 5% say they don't know if God exists, that is, are agnostics. These numbers, however, seem low. One Gallup poll indicated the number of atheists being as high as 17%. And other studies have claimed that, since there is still a social stigma associated with atheism, those holding such beliefs are hesitant to admit them openly. All these statistics should move us to ask, are there actually good reasons to believe that God, in particular the God of the Bible, exists? And are there not so good reasons for believing so? I'm Dr. David Heiduk, and here's my take.
When you read Scripture, you want to know that you're reading with the mind of the church. Verbum helps you read Scripture in the light of tradition by putting the Magisterion within reach on all of your devices. Connect your daily Scripture readings with the Catechism, Church Fathers, and Catholic commentaries. Access a world-class Catholic library on all of your devices. Pray through Scripture with step-by-step instructions on Lectio Divina. Right now, listeners of a Reason for Hope podcast can get started with Verbum with an extra free month. Take your spiritual reading, journaling, and studying to the next level with Verbum. To get started for free, visit the link above or below in the description.
And don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to this podcast and give us a 5-star rating. So before we discuss if there are good reasons to believe in the God of the Bible, let's look at some not-so-good ones. Or put another way, what are some common misconceptions about what believing means? I think a lot of people get what faith is wrong, and so they immediately decide that faith isn't for them. Therefore, I'd like to address a few of these misconceptions up front. And for the record, I'm not blaming anyone for having these misconceptions. Many believers may actually give the impression that these things are what it means to believe. But it is my contention that if someone's faith is based exclusively on these, that person will not hang on to their faith for very long. Because their faith lacks deeper roots, when they are tested, especially by having to make great personal sacrifices to live faithfully, they will be swiftly uprooted. Many people think that faith is equivalent to having a religious experience. Thus, they think that faith is God knocking you over the head or stopping you in your tracks by some sort of direct encounter with Him. This could be an overwhelming feeling of God's presence and love, some kind of visible sign, or even witnessing a miracle, however loosely you want to define that word. In other words, faith is something that happens to you. However, is faith really reducible to or even primarily about religious experiences or sentiments? What if you've never had or aren't even inclined to such feelings or tend to look at things that happen in the world a bit more matter-of-factly? Could faith really be reduced to things that seem more like they have to do with a particular kind of personality type or temperament? And what about when feelings change? Do we no longer believe because we don't feel God's presence anymore? And couldn't we, of course, be mistaken about our experiences and our interpretation about the so-called signs? Now, I'm not bashing religious experiences or having feelings of closeness to God. A relationship that merely involved a kind of cold, disinterested duty wouldn't be what anyone is looking for. Though, every relationship may have times of dryness. The same holds in our relationship with God. However, not everyone's relationship with God begins with fireworks. If you think it must, then you are apt to think faith isn't for you if you've never experienced them, and that would be a mistake. Another common misconception about faith is that faith is contrary to reason. Such a view tends to see faith as some kind of blind leap, at best, highly impractical, and at worst, sheer foolishness. Faith is seen as supremely unscientific, which is one of the only two deadly sins of our time, the other being intolerance, but I'll save that for another episode. Now, I would argue we actually have faith in science, or more specifically, in scientists. And whether or not that faith is well placed is a worthwhile discussion to have. Whatever the case, if you were to think that somehow faith is opposed to reason or contrary to science, then you would almost rightly reject it out of the box, especially in a time when no one wants to be labeled being a science denier. The good news for you is that faith is not contrary to reason. In fact, we believe for reasons, and faith is not a blind leap. It is actually quite practical. In fact, we can't live without it. Faith is even quite scientific. While not being reducible to inferring causes from effects, it does, in fact, do just this. And it calls for some kind of commitment to the truth of something, which we have good reason to make, even in the absence of absolute certainty. Which, by the way, most science does as well. Another common idea floating around about faith is that the main function of faith is to make our lives easier and better. From the outside, this can seem as if faith is some kind of psychological narcotic that enables us to get through life and sleep peacefully at night, shielding us from the reality that, in the words of Thomas Hobbes, the life of man is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Religion is an escape, the opium of the people, in the words of Karl Marx. Now, I do think that faith makes your life better, but how it does so is not necessarily in the way most would judge as better. Faith gives life meaning, gives the universe meaning, actually. However, one shouldn't believe because they want to be saved from a meaningless universe. They should believe because what they believe is true. Faith is no doubt useful, but you cannot have faith for utilitarian reasons. A related idea is the notion that the real function of religion, and God for that matter, is to comfort us, provide for our every want, and bring us earthly happiness. This is, of course, precisely not what faith is. And someone who thinks it is what faith is will soon be rudely awakened. In the words of the famous author and devout Catholic, Flannery O'Connor, what people don't realize is how much religion costs. They think faith is a big electric blanket, when of course, it is the cross. So what is faith, then? It is many things. For example, it is a supernatural virtue, infused at baptism, and a free gift of God. But I would like to focus on two aspects of what faith is in particular. First, faith is an act of the will. Faith is a decision to affirm something as true for which we have evidence, but not absolute certainty. Faith isn't something that happens to us. Though it is a gift and an infused virtue, it isn't something beyond our control. In this sense, faith is a human act. We will to believe. And we believe for reasons. Faith includes the intellect. There is evidence for what is believed, and good evidence. Yet ultimately, faith is a choice. Another aspect of faith is that it is a choice to assent to what God has revealed. And revelation is different from reason. The Catholic Church has always held that the question of whether God exists is really a question of human reason, not divine revelation. We can know God exists, as well as some of his attributes, from reason alone, apart from revelation. In the prayer called the Act of Faith, it doesn't state, "Oh my God, I firmly believe that you exist," but, "I firmly believe that you are one God in three divine persons." In other words, faith properly called pertains to revealed truths like the Trinity or the Incarnation, that is, to things we could not have known by reason. The Act of Faith continues, "I believe these and all the truths which the Holy Catholic Church teaches, because you have revealed them, who are eternal truth and wisdom, and can neither deceive nor be deceived." Notice the fact that God exists and that he is eternal truth are really statements that are presupposed. This is because we can know them by reason. Sure, divine revelation confirms them, but we do not need divine revelation to know them. God's existence and many of his attributes can be known by reason alone, by moving from visible effects seen in the world to their invisible cause. As St. Paul writes to the Romans, "For the invisible things of God, from the creation of the world, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, his eternal power also and divinity." And so, when we discuss the question of whether there's good reason to believe that the God of the Bible exists, we are not first and foremost discussing whether or not we should believe the Bible or whether or not the Bible is divinely revealed. I think there are good reasons to believe both of those things, but we will not be discussing them here. Instead, we will look to some of what reason can tell us about God's existence and some of his attributes. And what I think we will find is that it is strikingly consistent with the God of the Bible. But first, let's hear more about the sponsor for this episode.
When you read Scripture, you want to know that you're reading with the mind of the Church. Verbum helps you read Scripture in the light of the tradition by putting the Magisterion within reach on all of your devices. Connect your daily Scripture readings with the Catechism, Church Fathers, and Catholic commentaries. Access a world-class Catholic library on all of your devices. Pray through Scripture with step-by-step instructions on Lectio Divina. Right now, listeners of a Reason for Hope podcast can get started with Verbum with an extra free month. Take your spiritual reading, journaling, and studying to the next level with Verbum. To get started for free, visit the link above or below in the description. Once again, thanks for joining us for this episode of A Reason for Hope podcast. Your support helps us carry on the mission of evangelizing to the culture through high-quality media and events. If you've been enjoying our content, we ask you to prayerfully consider becoming a partner with us in this mission. You can do that by clicking the link above or below in the description, which will take you right to our donation page. There, you can choose to make a one-time or a monthly donation. By selecting podcasts in your Apply Your Donation Towards drop-down menu, you can be assured that this gift will go directly to the production of this podcast. We thank you in advance for your generosity. Now back to our episode.
To show why there are good reasons to believe in the God of the Bible, I am going to turn to one of the five proofs for God's existence put forth by St. Thomas Aquinas in his masterwork, the Summa Theologiae. The first of St. Thomas's proofs is the argument from motion. Now, motion here means change. We often think of motion exclusively in terms of locomotion, or a change in location, moving from one place to another. However, for Thomas, motion refers to something changing from a state of potentiality to a state of actuality. St. Thomas says, when we look at the world around us, we notice that things are in motion, or change, from potentiality to actuality. However, something cannot change from a state of potentiality to a state of actuality except by something already in a state of actuality. The example Aquinas gives is that wood, which is potentially hot, can only become actually hot by something like fire, which is actually hot. But that thing which is actual, by which something is moved from potential to actual, was itself moved from potentiality to actuality by something already actual. And so on, and so on, and so on. Everything that is moved by another, and it by another, and it by another. Well, you see how this keeps on going. However, it cannot go back infinitely. There must be a first mover, an unmoved mover, a being that is pure actuality without any potentiality, which is the ultimate cause of motion in things, that is, of anything becoming actualized at all. And this being we commonly call God. Now, God being pure act or pure actuality actually tells us a lot about God's attributes. A clue for the first thing it tells us comes from the name of the proof. God cannot be moved. He does not change. He is immutable. Change would mean there is a movement from potential to actual. But God is pure actuality without any potentiality. Thus, God cannot change. And since time cannot exist apart from change, and God cannot change because he is pure actuality, God must necessarily be eternal and outside of time. Another attribute we learn from God being pure actuality is that God is infinitely perfect. What is perfection except something attaining the full degree of its potentiality? Things in the world are a mixture of potentialities and actualities, and they are never fully actualized. Even if they could be, there would be potentialities they did not possess that other things had. God, however, has no potentiality at all, but is pure actuality. Thus, he must be the source of all potentiality moving to actuality, which means he must be infinitely perfect. Another of St. Thomas's proofs speaks of how if there are degrees of perfection in the world, there must be an infinitely perfect being as their cause. But I won't be covering that one today. You should look it up, though. Well, if God is infinitely perfect, that means he is not only good, true, beautiful, loving, and merciful, but that he is goodness itself, truth itself, beauty itself, love itself, and mercy itself. It also means that God is being itself. Ens subsistens is Aquinas' phrase. Because the more perfect something is, the more being it has. Now, believe it or not, we actually do talk like this in everyday life. If you went looking for a Christmas tree to cut down, and you came upon the one you thought looked like a perfect Christmas tree, you would say, "Now that's a tree." In other words, that tree resembles more of whatever it means to be a tree than the other trees you saw. It has more being. Well, an infinitely perfect being would not just be a being, but would be being itself, or supreme being. It is interesting to note that when God reveals his name, he simply says, "I am." Another of God's attributes that follows from God being pure actuality is that God is necessarily immaterial. In other words, he is pure spirit. Material things are an admixture of potentiality and actuality. But God is pure actuality. So God cannot be material. Now, since God is pure actuality, God must also be one. What is it that distinguishes one being from another in the world? It's differences in combinations of potentiality and actuality. However, God has no potentiality. And there is no way of distinguishing more than one being that is pure act from one another. And indeed, there could not be any such distinction at all. Therefore, God must be only one God. We could keep going. Because God is pure actuality, it follows that God must be all-knowing or omniscient. Because growth in knowledge necessarily means a movement from ignorance to knowledge, from potential to actual. And God is pure actuality, thus cannot have any trace of ignorance. Thus God knows all things. Also, a being that is pure act would be perfect in active power, since power stands as actuality in relation to potentiality. Thus God would necessarily be omnipotent or all-powerful, which would also be clear from God's being capable of bringing something into existence from nothing, which is impossible in the order of nature. Anyhow, you get the point. When you compile all these attributes, all of which follow logically from God being pure actuality, which we establish by reason alone, what do you find? A God that looks remarkably like the God of the Bible. Though we learn more about this God from divine revelation, things we could not know by reason, what we can know by reason points indisputably to the God of the Bible. And so, there are ample reasons to believe in the God of the Bible, even before you crack open its pages. Well, that's my take. If you have a topic you'd like my take on, comment below or send an email to r4hpodcast@gmail.com. Come back next time when we will tackle a new issue. Until then, run the race, fight the good fight, and keep the faith.